Since these categories are primarily schematic and efficient ones, and since it is more or less assumed that no Oriental can know himself the way an Orientalist can, any vision of the Orient ultimately comes to rely for its coherence and force on the person, institution, or discourse whose property it is. Any comprehensive vision is fundamentally conservative, and we have noted how in the history of ideas about the Near Orient in the West, these ideas have maintained themselves regardless of any evidence disputing them. Indeed, we can argue that these ideas produce evidence that proves their validity. The Orientalist is principally a kind of agent of such comprehensive visions. Lane is a typical instance of the way an individual believes himself to have subordinated his ideas, or even what he sees, to the exigencies of some scientific view of the whole phenomenon known collectively as the Orient, or the Oriental Nation. A vision, therefore, is static, just as the scientific categories informing late 19th century Orientalism are static. There is no recourse beyond the Semites or the Oriental mind. These are final terminals, holding every variety of Oriental behavior within a general view of the whole field. As a discipline, as a profession, as specialized language or discourse, Orientalism is staked upon the permanence of the whole Orient, for without the Orient, there can be no consistent, intelligible, and articulated knowledge called Orientalism. Thus, the Orient belongs to Orientalism, just as it is assumed that there is pertinent information belonging to or about the Orient. Against this static system of synchronic essentialism I have called vision, because it presumes that the whole Orient can be seen panoptically, there is a constant pressure. The source of pressure is narrative, in that if any Oriental detail can be shown to move or to develop, diachrony is introduced into the system. What seemed stable, and the Orient is synonymous with stability and unchanging eternality, now appears unstable. Instability suggests that history, with its disruptive detail, its currents of change, its tendency towards growth, decline, or dramatic movement, is possible in the Orient and for the Orient. History, and the narrative by which history is represented, argue that vision is insufficient, that the Orient, as an unconditional ontological category, does an injustice to the potential of reality for change. Moreover, narrative is the specific form taken by written history to counter the permanence of vision. Lane sensed the dangers of narrative when he refused to give linear shape to himself and to his information, preferring instead the monumental form of encyclopedic or lexicographical vision. Narrative asserts the power of men to be born, develop, and die. The tendency of institutions and actualities to change. The likelihood that modernity and contemporaneity will finally overtake classical civilizations. Above all, it asserts that the domination of reality by vision is no more than a will to power. A will to truth and interpretation, and not an objective condition of history. Narrative, in short, introduces an opposing point of view, perspective, consciousness, to the unitary web of vision. It violates the serene Apollonian fictions asserted by vision. When, as a result of World War I, the Orient was made to enter history, it was the Orientalist as agent who did the work. Hannah Arendt has made the brilliant observation that the counterpart of the bureaucracy is the imperial agent, which is to say that if the collective academic endeavor called Orientalism was a bureaucratic institution based on a certain conservative vision of the Orient, then the servants of such a vision in the Orient were imperial agents like T.E. Lawrence. In his work, we can see most clearly the conflict between narrative history and vision as, in his words, the new imperialism attempted an active tide of imposing responsibility on the local peoples of the Orient. The competition between the European powers now caused them to prod the Orient into active life, to press the Orient into service, to turn the Orient from unchanging Oriental passivity into militant modern life. It would be important, nevertheless, never to let the Orient go its own way or get out of hand, the canonical view being that Orientals had no tradition of freedom. The great drama of Lawrence's work is that it symbolizes the struggle, first to stimulate the Orient, lifeless, timeless, forceless, into movement. Second, to impose upon that movement an essentially Western shape. Third, to contain the new and aroused Orient in a personal vision, whose retrospective mode includes a powerful sense of failure and betrayal. I meant to make a new nation, to restore a lost influence, to give 20 millions of Semites the foundation on which to build an inspired dream palace of their national thoughts. All the subject provinces of the empire to me were not worth one dead English boy. If I have restored to the East some self-respect, a goal, ideals, if I have made the standard rule of white over red more exigent, I have fitted those peoples in a degree for the new commonwealth in which the dominant races will forget their brute achievements, and white and red and yellow and brown and black will stand up together without side glances in the service of the world. None of this, whether as intention, as an actual undertaking, or as a failed project, would have been remotely possible without the white Orientalist perspective at the outset. The Jew in the metropole at Brighton, the miser, the worshipper of Adonis, the lecher in the stews of Damascus were alike signs of the Semitic capacity for enjoyment and expressions of the same nerve which gave us at the other pole the self-denial of the Essenes, or the early Christians, or the first Khalifas, finding the ways to heaven fairest for the poor in spirit. The Semite hovered between lust and self-denial. Lawrence is backed in such statements by a respectable tradition stretching like a lighthouse beam through the whole 19th century. At its light emanating center, of course, is the Orient, and that is powerful enough to light up both the gross and the refined topographies within its range. The Jew, the worshipper of Adonis, the Damascene lecher, are signs not so much of humanity, let us say, as of a semiotic field called Semitic and built into coherence by the Semitic branch of Orientalism. Inside this field, certain things were possible. Arabs could be swung on an idea as on a cord, for the unpledged allegiance of their minds made them obedient servants. None of them would escape the bond till success had come, and with it responsibility and duty and engagement. Then the idea was gone and the work ended, in ruins. Without a creed, they could be taken to the four corners of the world, but not to heaven, by being shown the riches of the earth and the pleasures of it. But if, on the road, they met the prophet of an idea, who had nowhere to lay his head, and who depended for his food on charity or birds, then they would all leave their wealth for his inspiration. They were as unstable as water, and like water would perhaps finally prevail. Since the dawn of life, in successive waves, they had been dashing themselves against the coasts of flesh. Each wave was broken. One such wave, and not the least, I raised and rolled before the breath of an idea, till it reached its crest and toppled over and fell at Damascus. The wash of that wave, thrown back by the resistance of vested things, will provide the matter of the following wave, when in fullness of time the sea shall be raised once more. Could, would, and if, are Lawrence's way of inserting himself in the field, as it were. Thus, the possibility is prepared for the last sentence, in which, as manipulator of the Arabs, Lawrence puts himself at their head. Like Conrad's Kurtz, Lawrence has cut himself loose from the Earth so as to become identified with a new reality in order, he says later, that he might be responsible for hustling into form, the new Asia which time was inexorably bringing upon us. The Arab revolt acquires meaning only as Lawrence designs meaning for it. His meaning imparted thus to Asia was a triumph, a mood of enlargement, in that we felt that we had assumed another's pain or experience, his personality. The Orientalist has become now the representative Oriental, unlike earlier participant observers such as Lane, for whom the Orient was something kept carefully at bay. But there is an unresolvable conflict in Lawrence between the white man and the Oriental, and although he does not explicitly say so, this conflict essentially restages in his mind the historical conflict between East and West. Conscious of his power over the Orient, conscious also of his duplicity, unconscious of anything in the Orient that would suggest to him that history, after all, is history, and that even without him, the Arabs would finally attend to their quarrel with the Turks, Lawrence reduces the entire narrative of the revolt, its momentary successes and its bitter failure, to his vision of himself as an unresolved, standing civil war. Yet in reality we had borne the vicarious for our own sakes, or at least because it was pointed for our benefit, and could escape from this knowledge only by a make-belief in sense as well as in motive. There seemed no straight walking for us leaders in this crooked lane of conduct, ring within ring of unknown, shame-faced motives canceling or double-charging their precedence. To this intimate sense of defeat, Lawrence was later to add a theory about the old men who stole the triumph from him. In any event, what matters to Lawrence is that as a white expert, the legatee of years of academic and popular wisdom about the Orient, he is able to subordinate his style of being to theirs, thereafter to assume the role of Oriental prophet, giving shape to a movement in the New Asia. And when, for whatever reason, the movement fails, it is taken over by others, its aims are betrayed, its dream of independence invalidated, it is Lawrence's disappointment that counts. So far from being a mere man lost in the great rush of confusing events, Lawrence equates himself fully with the struggle of the New Asia to be born. Whereas Aeschylus had represented Asia mourning its losses, and Nerval had expressed his disappointment in the Orient for not being more glamorous than he had wanted, Lawrence becomes both the mourning continent and a subjective consciousness expressing an almost cosmic disenchantment. In the end, Lawrence, and thanks not only to Lowell Thomas and Robert Graves, and Lawrence's vision, became the very symbol of Oriental trouble. Lawrence, in short, had assumed responsibility for the Orient by interspersing his knowing experience between the reader and history. Indeed, what Lawrence presents to the reader is an unmediated expert power, the power to be, for a brief time, the Orient. All the events putatively ascribed to the historical Arab revolt are reduced, finally, to Lawrence's experiences on its behalf. In such a case, therefore, style is not only the power to symbolize such enormous generalities as Asia, the Orient, or the Arabs, it is also a form of displacement and incorporation by which one voice becomes a whole history and, for the white Westerner, as reader or writer, the only kind of Orient it is possible to know. Just as Renan had mapped the field of possibility open to the Semites in culture, thought, and language, so too Lawrence charts the space, and indeed appropriates that space, and time of modern Asia. The effect of this style is that it brings Asia tantalizingly close to the West, but only for a brief moment. We are left at the end with a sense of the pathetic distance still separating us from an Orient destined to bear its foreignness as a mark of its permanent estrangement from the West. This is the disappointing conclusion corroborated contemporaneously by the ending of E.M. Forster's A Passage to India, where Aziz and Fielding attempt and fail at reconciliation. "Why can't we be friends now?" said the other, holding him affectionately. "It's what I want. It's what you want." But the horses didn't want it. They swerved apart. The earth didn't want it, sending up rocks through which riders must pass single file. The temples, the tank, the jail, the palace, the birds, the carrion, the guest house, that came into view as they issued from the gap and saw Mao beneath. They didn't want it, they said in their hundred voices. No, not yet. And the sky said, no, not there. This style, this compact definition, is what the Orient will always come up against. Despite its pessimism, there is a positive political message behind its phrases. The gulf between East and West can be modulated, as Cromer and Balfour knew well, by superior Western knowledge and power. Lawrence's vision is complemented in France by Maurice Barrès's Une enquête au pays du Levant, the record of a journey through the Near Orient in 1914. Like so many works before it, the Enquête is a work of recapitulation, whose author not only searches out sources and origins of Western culture in the Orient, but also redoes Nerval, Flaubert, and Lamartine in their voyages to the Orient. For Barrès, however, there is an additional political dimension to his journey. He seeks proof and conclusive evidence for a constructive French role in the East. Yet the difference between French and British expertise remains. The former manages an actual conjunction of peoples and territory, whereas the latter deals with a realm of spiritual possibility. For Barrès, the French presence is best seen in French schools, where, as he says of a school in Alexandria, it is ravishing to see those little Oriental girls welcoming and so wonderfully reproducing the fantaisie and the melody, in their spoken French, of the Île-de-France. If France does not actually have any colonies there, she is not entirely without possessions. There is, there in the Orient, a feeling about France which is so religious and strong that it is capable of absorbing and reconciling all our most diverse aspirations. In the Orient, we represent spirituality, justice, and the category of the ideal. England is powerful there, Germany is all-powerful, but we possess Oriental souls. Arguing vociferously with Jaurès, this celebrated European doctor proposes to vaccinate Asia against its own illnesses, to occidentalize the Orientals, to bring them into salubrious contact with France. Yet even in these projects, Barrès's vision preserves the very distinction between East and West he claims to be mitigating. How will we be able to form for ourselves an intellectual elite with which we can work, made out of Orientals who would not be deracinated, who would continue to evolve according to their own norms, who would remain penetrated by family traditions, and who would thus form a link between us and the mass of natives? How will we create relationships with a view towards preparing the way for agreements and treaties, which would be the desirable form taken by our political future in the Orient? All these things are finally all about soliciting in these strange peoples the taste for maintaining contact with our intelligence, even though this taste may in fact come out of their own sense of their national destiny. The emphasis in the last sentence is Barrès's own. Since, unlike Lawrence and Hogarth, whose book The Wandering Scholar is the wholly informative and unromantic record of two trips to the Levant in 1896 and 1910, he writes of a world of distant probabilities. He is more prepared to imagine the Orient as going its own way. Yet the bond, or leash, between East and West that he advocates is designed to permit a constant variety of intellectual pressure going from West to East. Barrès sees things, not in terms of waves, battles, spiritual adventures, but in terms of the cultivation of intellectual imperialism, as ineradicable as it is subtle. The British vision, exemplified by Lawrence, is of the mainstream Orient, of peoples, political organizations, and movements guided and held in check by the white man's expert tutelage. The Orient is our Orient, our people, our dominions. Discriminations between elites and the masses are less likely to be made by the British than by the French, whose perceptions and policy were always based on minorities and on the insidious pressures of spiritual community between France and its colonial children. The British agent Orientalist, Lawrence, Bell, Filby, Storrs, Hogarth, during and after World War I, took over both the role of expert adventurer eccentric, created in the 19th century by Lane, Burton, Hester Stanhope, and the role of colonial authority, whose position is in a central place next to the indigenous ruler. Lawrence with the Hashemites, Filby with the House of Saud, are the two best-known instances. British Oriental expertise fashioned itself around consensus and orthodoxy and sovereign authority. French Oriental expertise between the wars concerned itself with heterodoxy, spiritual ties, eccentrics. It is no accident, then, that the two major scholarly careers of this period, one British, one French, were H.A.R. Gibbs and Louis Massignon's, one whose interest was defined by the notion of sunnah, or orthodoxy in Islam, the other whose focus was on the quasi-Christ-like, theosophical Sufi figure Mansur al-Halaj. I shall return to these two major Orientalists a little later. If I have concentrated so much on imperial agents and policymakers instead of scholars in this section, it was to accentuate the major shift in Orientalism, knowledge about the Orient, intercourse with it, from an academic to an instrumental attitude. What accompanies the shift is a change in the attitude as well of the individual Orientalist, who need no longer see himself, as Lane, Sacy, Renan, Gossin, Müller, and others did, as belonging to a sort of guild community with its own internal traditions and rituals. Now, the Orientalist has become the representative man of his Western culture, a man who compresses within his own work a major duality of which that work, regardless of its specific form, is the symbolic expression. Occidental consciousness, knowledge, science taking hold of the furthest Oriental reaches as well as the most minute Oriental particulars. Formally, the Orientalist sees himself as accomplishing the union of Orient and Occident, but mainly by reasserting the technological, political, and cultural supremacy of the West. History, in such a union, is radically attenuated if not banished. Viewed as a current of development, as a narrative strand, or as a dynamic force unfolding systematically and materially in time and space, human history, of the East or the West, is subordinated to an essentialist, idealist conception of Occident and Orient. Because he feels himself to be standing at the very rim of the East-West divide, the Orientalist not only speaks in vast generalities, he also seeks to convert each aspect of Oriental or Occidental life into an unmediated sign of one or the other geographical half. The interchange in the Orientalist's writing between his expert self and his testimonial beholding self as Western representative is preeminently worked out in visual terms. Here is a typical passage quoted by Gibb from Duncan MacDonald's classic work, The Religious Attitude and Life in Islam, 1909. The Arabs show themselves not as especially easy of belief, but as hard-headed, materialistic, questioning, doubting, scoffing at their own superstitions and usages, fond of tests of the supernatural, and all this in a curiously light-minded, almost childish fashion. the governing verb is show, which here gives us to understand that the Arabs display themselves, willingly or unwillingly, to and for expert scrutiny. The number of attributes ascribed to them by its crowded set of sheer appositions causes the Arabs to acquire a sort of existential weightlessness. Thereby, the Arabs are made to rejoin the very broad designation, common to modern anthropological thought, of the childish primitive. What MacDonald also implies is that for such descriptions there is a peculiarly privileged position occupied by the Western Orientalist, whose representative function is precisely to show what needs to be seen. All specific history is capable of being seen thus at the apex, or the sensitive frontier of Orient and Occident together. The complex dynamics of human life, what I have been calling history as narrative, becomes either irrelevant or trivial in comparison with the circular vision by which the details of Oriental life serve merely to reassert the Orientalness of the subject and the Westernness of the observer. If such a vision in some ways recalls Dante's, we should by no means fail to notice what an enormous difference there is between this Orient and Dante's. Evidence here is meant to be, and probably is considered, scientific. Its pedigree, genealogically speaking, is European intellectual and human science during the 19th century. Moreover, the Orient is no simple marvel, or an enemy, or a branch of exotica. It is a political actuality of great and significant moment. Like Lawrence, MacDonald cannot really detach his representative characteristics as a Westerner from his role as a scholar. Thus, his vision of Islam, as much as Lawrence's of the Arabs, implicates definition of the object with the identity of the person defining. All Arab Orientals must be accommodated to a vision of an Oriental type as constructed by the Western scholar, as well as to a specific encounter with the Orient in which the Westerner re-grasps the Orient's essence as a consequence of his intimate estrangement from it. For Lawrence as for Forster, this latter sensation produces the despondency as well of personal failure. For such scholars as MacDonald, it strengthens the Orientalist discourse itself. And it puts that discourse abroad in the world of culture, politics, and actuality. In the period between the wars, as we can easily judge from, say, Malraux's novels, the relations between East and West assumed a currency that was both widespread and anxious. The signs of Oriental claims for political independence were everywhere. Certainly, in the dismembered Ottoman Empire, they were encouraged by the Allies, and, as is perfectly evident in the whole Arab revolt and its aftermath, quickly became problematic. The Orient now appeared to constitute a challenge, not just to the West in general, but to the West's spirit, knowledge, and imperium. After a good century of constant intervention in and study of the Orient, the West's role in an East itself responding to the crises of modernity seemed considerably more delicate. There was the issue of outright occupation. There was the issue of the mandated territories. There was the issue of European competition in the Orient. There was the issue of dealing with native elites, native popular movements, and native demands for self-government and independence. There was the issue of civilizational contacts between Orient and Occident. Such issues forced reconsideration of Western knowledge of the Orient. No less a personage than Sylvain Lévy, president of the Société Asiatique between 1928 and 1935, professor of Sanskrit at the Collège de France, reflected seriously in 1925 on the urgency of the East-West problem. Our duty is to understand Oriental civilization. The humanistic problem, which consists on an intellectual level in making a sympathetic and intelligent effort to understand foreign civilizations in both their past and their future forms, is specifically posed for us Frenchmen. Although similar sentiments could have been expressed by an Englishman, the problem was a European one. In a practical way, with regard to our great Asiatic colonies. These peoples are the inheritors of a long tradition of history, of art, and of religion, the sense of which they have not entirely lost and which they are probably anxious to prolong. We have assumed the responsibility of intervening in their development, sometimes without consulting them, sometimes in answer to their request. We claim, rightly or wrongly, to represent a superior civilization, and because of the right given us by virtue of this superiority, which we regularly affirm with such assurance as makes it seem incontestable to the natives, we have called in question all their native traditions. In a general way, then, wherever the European has intervened, the native has perceived himself with a sort of general despair, which was really poignant since he felt that the sum of his well-being, in the moral sphere more than in sheer material terms, instead of increasing, had in fact diminished. All of which has made the foundation of his social life seem to be flimsy and to crumble under him, and the golden pillars on which he had thought to rebuild his life now seem no more than tinseled cardboard. This disappointment has been translated into rancor from one end to the other of the Orient, and this rancor is very close now to turning to hate, and hate only waits for the right moment in order to turn into action. If, because of laziness or incomprehension, Europe does not make the effort that its interests alone require from it, then the Asiatic drama will approach the crisis point. It is here that that science which is a form of life and an instrument of policy, that is, wherever our interests are at stake, owes it to itself to penetrate native civilization and life in their intimacy in order to discover their fundamental values and durable characteristics, rather than to smother native life with the incoherent threat of European civilizational imports. We must offer ourselves to these civilizations as we do our other products, that is, on the local exchange market. Levy has no difficulty in connecting Orientalism with politics, for the long, or rather the prolonged, Western intervention in the East cannot be denied, either in its consequences for knowledge or in its effect upon the hapless native. Together, the two add up to what could be a menacing future. For all his expressed humanism, his admirable concern for fellow creatures, Levy conceives the present juncture in unpleasantly constricted terms. The Oriental is imagined to feel his world threatened by a superior civilization, yet his motives are impelled, not by some positive desire for freedom, political independence, or cultural achievement on their own terms, but instead by rancor or jealous malice. The panacea offered for this potentially ugly turn of affairs is that the Orient be marketed for a Western consumer, be put before him as one among numerous wares beseeching his attention. By a single stroke, you will defuse the Orient, by letting it think itself to be an equal quantity on the Occidental marketplace of ideas, and you will appease Western fears of an Oriental tidal wave. At bottom, of course, Levy's principal point, and his most telling confession, is that unless something is done about the Orient, the Asiatic drama will approach the crisis point. Asia suffers, yet in its suffering it threatens Europe. The eternal, bristling frontier endures between East and West, almost unchanged since classical antiquity. What Levy says as the most august of modern Orientalists is echoed with less subtlety by cultural humanists. Item. In 1925, the French periodical Les Cahiers du Moi conducted a survey among notable intellectual figures. The writers canvassed included Orientalists, Levy, Émile Senard, as well as literary men like André Gide, Paul Valéry, and Edmond Jalloux. The questions dealt with relations between Orient and Occident in a timely, not to say brazenly provocative way, and this already indicates something about the cultural ambiance of the period. We will immediately recognize how ideas of the sort promulgated in Orientalist scholarship have now reached the level of accepted truth. One question asks whether Orient and Occident are mutually impenetrable. The idea was Maeterlinck's, or not. Another asks whether or not Oriental influence represented un péril grave, Henri Massy's words, to French thought. A third asks about those values in Occidental culture to which its superiority over the Orient can be ascribed. Valéry's response seems to me worth quoting from, so forthright are the lines of its argument, and so time-honored, at least in the early 20th century. From the cultural point of view, I do not think that we have much to fear now from the Oriental influence. It is not unknown to us. We owe to the Orient all the beginnings of our arts and of a great deal of our knowledge. We can very well welcome what now comes out of the Orient, if something new is coming out of there, which I very much doubt. This doubt is precisely our guarantee and our European weapon. Besides, the real question in such matters is to digest. But that has always been, just as precisely, the great specialty of the European mind through the ages. Our role is therefore to maintain this power of choice, of universal comprehension, of the transformation of everything into our own substance, powers which have made us what we are. The Greeks and the Romans showed us how to deal with the monsters of Asia, how to treat them by analysis, how to extract them from their quintessence. The Mediterranean basin seems to me to be like a closed vessel where the essences of the vast Orient have always come in order to be condensed. If European culture generally has digested the Orient, certainly Valéry was aware that one specific agency for doing the job has been Orientalism. In the world of Wilsonian principles of national self-determination, Valéry relies confidently on analyzing the Orient's threat away. The power of choice is mainly for Europe first to acknowledge the Orient as the origin of European science, then to treat it as a superseded origin. Thus, in another context, Balfour could regard the native inhabitants of Palestine as having priority on the land, but nowhere near the subsequent authority to keep it. The mere wishes of 700,000 Arabs, he said, were of no moment compared to the destiny of an essentially European colonial movement. Asia represented, then, the unpleasant likelihood of a sudden eruption that would destroy our world, as John Buchan put it in 1922. The earth is seething with incoherent power and unorganized intelligence. Have you ever reflected on the case of China? There you have millions of quick brains stifled in trumpery crafts. They have no direction, no driving power, so the sum of their efforts is futile, and the world laughs at China. But if China organized itself, as it would be no laughing matter. Europe's effort, therefore, was to maintain itself as what Valéry called une machine puissante, absorbing what it could from outside Europe, converting everything to its use, intellectually and materially, keeping the Orient selectively organized, or disorganized. Yet, this could be done only through clarity of vision and analysis. Unless the Orient was seen for what it was, its power, military, material, spiritual, would sooner or later overwhelm Europe. The great colonial empires, great systems of systematic repression, existed to fend off the feared eventuality. Colonial subjects, as George Orwell saw them in Marrakesh in 1939, must not be seen except as a kind of continental emanation. African, Asian, Oriental. When you walk through a town like this, 200,000 inhabitants, of whom at least 20,000 own literally nothing except the rags they stand up in, when you see how the people live, and still more, how easily they die, It is always difficult to believe that you are walking among human beings. All colonial empires are in reality founded upon that fact. The people have brown faces. Besides, they have so many of them. Are they really the same flesh as yourself? Do they even have names? Or are they merely a kind of undifferentiated brown stuff, about as individual as bees or coral insects? They arise out of the earth, they sweat and starve for a few years, and then they sink back into the nameless mounds of the graveyard, and nobody notices that they are gone. And even the graves themselves soon fade back into the soil. Aside from the picturesque characters offered European readers in the exotic fiction of minor writers, Pierre Loti, Marmaduke Pickthall, and the like, the non-European known to Europeans is precisely what Orwell says about him. He is either a figure of fun or an atom in a vast collectivity designated in ordinary or cultivated discourse as an undifferentiated type called Oriental, African, Yellow, Brown, or Muslim. To such abstractions, Orientalism had contributed its power of generalization, converting instances of a civilization into ideal bearers of its values, ideas, and positions, which, in turn, the Orientalists had found in the Orient and transformed into common cultural currency. If we reflect that Raymond Schwab brought out his brilliant biography of Anquetil du Perron in 1934 and began those studies which were to put Orientalism in its proper cultural context, we must also remark that what he did was in stark contrast to his fellow artists and intellectuals, for whom Orient and Occident were still the second-hand abstractions they were for Valéry. Not that Pound, Eliot, Yeats, Arthur Whaley, Fenollosa, Paul Claudel, in his Connaissance de l'Est, Victor Segalen, and others were ignoring the wisdom of the East, as Max Müller had called it a few generations earlier. Rather, the culture viewed the Orient, and Islam in particular, with the mistrust with which its learned attitude to the Orient had always been freighted. A suitable instance of this contemporary attitude at its most explicit is to be found in a series of lectures given at the University of Chicago in 1924 on The Occident and the Orient by Valentine Chirol, a well-known European newspaper man of great experience in the East. His purpose was to make clear to educated Americans that the Orient was not as far off as perhaps they believed. His line is a simple one, that Orient and Occident are irreducibly opposed to each other, and that the Orient, in particular Mohammedanism, is one of the great world forces responsible for the deepest lines of cleavage in the world. Chirol's sweeping generalizations are, I think, adequately represented by the titles of his six lectures. Their Ancient Battleground. The Passing of the Ottoman Empire, The Peculiar Case of Egypt. The Great British Experiment in Egypt. Protectorates and Mandates. The New Factor of Bolshevism. And Some General Conclusions. To such relatively popular accounts of the Orient as Chirol's, we can add a testimonial by Elie Faure, who in his ruminations draws, like Chirol, on history, cultural expertise, and the familiar contrast between white Occidentalism and colored Orientalism. While delivering himself of paradoxes like Le carnage permanent de l'indifférence orientale, for unlike us, they have no conception of peace, Faure goes on to show that the Orientals' bodies are lazy, that the Orient has no conception of history, of the nation, or of patrie, that the Orient is essentially mystical, and so on. Faure argues that unless the Oriental learns to be rational, to develop techniques of knowledge and positivity, there can be no rapprochement between East and West. A far more subtle and learned account of the East-West dilemma can be found in Fernand Baldensperger's essay, où s'affrontent l'Orient et l'Occident intellectuel. But he too speaks of an inherent Oriental disdain for the idea, for mental discipline, for rational interpretation. Spoken as they are out of the depths of European culture, by writers who actually believe themselves to be speaking on behalf of that culture, such commonplaces, for they are perfect idées reçues, cannot be explained simply as examples of provincial chauvinism. They are not that, and, as will be evident to anyone who knows anything about Fors and Baldensperger's other work, are the more paradoxical for not being that. Their background is the transformation of the exacting, professional science of Orientalism, whose function in 19th century culture had been the restoration to Europe of a lost portion of humanity, but which had become, in the 20th century, both an instrument of policy and, more important, a code by which Europe could interpret both itself and the Orient to itself. For reasons discussed earlier in this book, modern Orientalism already carried within itself the imprint of the great European fear of Islam, and this was aggravated by the political challenges of the entre-deux-guerres. My point is that the metamorphosis of a relatively innocuous philological subspecialty into a capacity for managing political movements, administering colonies, making nearly apocalyptic statements representing the white man's difficult civilizing mission, all this is something at work within a purportedly liberal culture, one full of concern for its vaunted norms of Catholicity, plurality, and open-mindedness. In fact, what took place was the very opposite of liberal, the hardening of doctrine and meaning imparted by science into truth. For if such truth reserved for itself the right to judge the Orient as immutably Oriental in the ways I have indicated, then liberality was no more than a form of oppression and mentalistic prejudice. The extent of such illiberality was not, and is not, often recognized from within the culture, for reasons that this book is trying to explore. It is heartening, nevertheless, that such illiberality has occasionally been challenged. Here is an instance from I.A. Richards' foreword to his Mencius on the Mind, 1932. We can quite easily substitute Oriental for Chinese in what follows. As to the effects of an increased knowledge of Chinese thought upon the West, it is interesting to notice that a writer so unlikely to be thought either ignorant or careless as M. Etienne Gilson can yet, in the English preface of his The Philosophy of St. Thomas Aquinas, speak of Thomistic philosophy as accepting and gathering up the whole of human tradition. This is how we all think. To us, the Western world is still the world, or the part of the world that counts. But an impartial observer would perhaps say that such provincialism is dangerous, and we are not yet so happy in the West that we can be sure that we are not suffering from its effects. Richards' argument advances claims for the exercise of what he calls multiple definition, a genuine type of pluralism, with the combativeness of systems of definition eliminated. Whether or not we accept his counter to Gilson's provincialism, we can accept the proposition that liberal humanism, of which Orientalism has historically been one department, retards the process of enlarged and enlarging meaning through which true understanding can be attained. What took the place of enlarged meaning in 20th century Orientalism, that is, within the technical field, is the subject most immediately at hand. 3. Modern Anglo-French Orientalism in fullest flower. Because we have become accustomed to think of a contemporary expert on some branch of the Orient or some aspect of its life as a specialist in area studies, we have lost a vivid sense of how, until around World War II, the Orientalist was considered to be a generalist, with a great deal of specific knowledge, of course, who had highly developed skills for making summational statements. By summational statements, I mean that in formulating a relatively uncomplicated idea, say, about Arabic grammar or Indian religion, the Orientalist would be understood and would understand himself as also making a statement about the Orient as a whole, thereby summing it up. Thus, every discrete study of one bit of Oriental material would also confirm in a summary way the profound orientality of the material. And since it was commonly believed that the whole Orient hung together in some profoundly organic way, it made perfectly good hermeneutical sense for the Orientalist scholar to regard the material evidence he dealt with as ultimately leading to a better understanding of such things as the Oriental character, mind, ethos, or world spirit. Most of the first two chapters of this book have made similar arguments about earlier periods in the history of Orientalist thought. The differentiation in its later history that concerns us here, however, is the one between the periods immediately before and after World War I. In both instances, as with the earlier periods, the Orient is Oriental, no matter the specific case, and no matter the style or technique used to describe it. The difference between the two periods in question is the reason given by the Orientalist for seeing the essential orientality of the Orient. A good example of the pre-war rationale can be found in the following passage by Snook Hurhonje, taken from his 1899 review of Eduard Zachau's Mohammedanisches Recht. The law, which in practice had to make ever greater concessions to the use and customs of the people and the arbitrariness of their rulers, nevertheless retained a considerable influence on the intellectual life of the Muslims. Therefore, it remains, and still is for us too, an important subject of study, not only for abstract reasons connected with the history of law, civilization, and religion, but also for practical purposes. The more intimate the relations of Europe with the Muslim East become, the more Muslim countries fall under European suzerainty, the more important it is for us Europeans to become acquainted with the intellectual life, the religious law, and the conceptual background of Islam. Although Hurhonje allows that something so abstract as Islamic law did occasionally yield to the pressure of history and society, he is more interested than not in retaining the abstraction for intellectual use because in its broad outline, Islamic law confirms the disparity between East and West. For Hurhonje, the distinction between Orient and Occident was no mere academic or popular cliché. Quite the contrary. For him, it signified the essential, historical power relationship between the two. Knowledge of the Orient either proves, enhances, or deepens the difference by which European suzerainty, the phrase has a venerable 19th century pedigree, is extended effectively over Asia. To know the Orient as a whole, then, is to know it because it is entrusted to one's keeping, if one is a Westerner. An almost symmetrical passage to Hurhonje's is to be found in the concluding paragraph of Gibbs' article, Literature, in The Legacy of Islam, published in 1931. After having described the three casual contacts between East and West up till the 18th century, Gibb then proceeds to the 19th century. Following on these three moments of casual contact, the German Romantics turned again to the East, and for the first time made it their conscious aim to open a way for the real heritage of Oriental poetry to enter into the poetry of Europe. The 19th century, with its new sense of power and superiority, seemed to clang the gate decisively in the face of their design. Today, on the other hand, there are signs of a change. Oriental literature has begun to be studied again for its own sake, and a new understanding of the East is being gained. As this knowledge spreads and the East recovers its rightful place in the life of humanity, Oriental literature may once again perform its historic function and assist us to liberate ourselves from the narrow and oppressive conceptions which would limit all that is significant in literature, thought, and history to our own segment of the globe. Gibbs' phrase, "for its own sake," is in diametrical opposition to the string of reasons subordinated to Herronie's declaration about European suzerainty over the East. What remains, nevertheless, is that seemingly inviolable overall identity of something called the East and something else called the West. Such entities have a use for each other, and it is plainly Gibbs' laudable intention to show that the influence on Western of Oriental literature need not be, in its results, what Brunetière had called a national disgrace. Rather, the East could be confronted as a sort of humanistic challenge to the local confines of Western ethnocentricity. His earlier solicitation of Goethe's idea of Weltliteratur notwithstanding, Gibbs' call for humanistic inter-inanimation between East and West reflects the changed political and cultural realities of the post-war era. European suzerainty over the Orient had not passed, but it had evolved, in British Egypt, from a more or less placid acceptance by the natives into a more and more contested political issue compounded by fractious native demands for independence. These were the years of constant British trouble with Zaghloul, the Wafd Party, and the like. Moreover, since 1925, there had been a worldwide economic recession, and this, too, increased the sense of tension that Gibbs' prose reflects. But the specifically cultural message in what he says is the most compelling. "Heed the Orient," he seems to be telling his reader, "for its use to the Western mind in the struggle to overcome narrowness, oppressive specialization, and limited perspectives." The ground had shifted considerably from Hurronje to Gibb, as had the priorities. No longer did it go without much controversy that Europe's domination over the Orient was almost a fact of nature, nor was it assumed that the Orient was in need of Western enlightenment. What mattered during the interwar years was a cultural self-definition that transcended the provincial and the xenophobic. For Gibb, the West has need of the Orient as something to be studied because it releases the spirit from sterile specialization. It eases the affliction of excessive parochial and nationalistic self-centeredness. It increases one's grasp of the really central issues in the study of culture. If the Orient appears more a partner in this new rising dialectic of cultural self-consciousness, it is, first, because the Orient is more of a challenge now than it was before, and second, because the West is entering a relatively new phase of cultural crisis, caused in part by the diminishment of Western suzerainty over the rest of the world. Therefore, in the best Orientalist work done during the interwar period, represented in the impressive careers of Massignon and Gibb himself, we will find elements in common with the best humanistic scholarship of the period. Thus, the summational attitude of which I spoke earlier can be regarded as the Orientalist equivalent of attempts in the purely Western humanities to understand culture as a whole, anti-positivistically, intuitively, sympathetically. Both the Orientalist and the non-Orientalist begin with the sense that Western culture is passing through an important phase, whose main feature is the crisis imposed on it by such threats as barbarism, narrow technical concerns, moral aridity, strident nationalism, and so forth. The idea of using specific texts, for instance, to work from the specific to the general, to understand the whole life of a period and consequently of a culture, is common to those humanists in the West inspired by the work of Wilhelm Dilthey, as well as to towering Orientalist scholars like Massignon and Gibb. the project of revitalizing philology, as it is found in the work of Curtius, Fossler, Auerbach, Spitzer, Gundolf, Hofmannsthal, has its counterpart, therefore, in the invigorations provided to strictly technical